You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There is a chance, although not a great chance, that an asteroid will collide with the Earth in the next 200 years. In National Geographic magazine's September cover story, Mysteries of the Solar System, science writer Michael Greshko wrote about a space mission to an asteroid that could provide information on how the Earth was formed and how an asteroid could be steered away from Earth. Michael Greshko, honored to have you on the program. First of all,
thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Let me start with, what is Lucy?
Well, Lucy is one of a kind of a fleet of spacecraft that the world space agencies have been sending to some of the smaller objects in our solar system, asteroids, comets, over the last few years. There's some missions like NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft that's visiting these potentially hazardous near-Earth asteroids. Lucy specifically is a really cool mission that's going to be going out to these swarms of asteroids that have very similar orbits to Jupiter, called the Jupiter Trojans. The solar system's origins were fairly chaotic. The planets, at least the really big ones, don't seem to have formed where they orbit today. So how they arrived where they are today is a big question. What Lucy will find out near Jupiter in these sort of swarms of asteroids out there will inform models for how the solar system kind of shook itself into its current architecture, which will provide more insights into how the planets formed in the first place.
Well, you know, one of the big questions that you write about in the cover story is how Earth became, and I'll use your words, an oasis for life when it formed so close to the sun. Talk about that a little
bit. Yeah. That's been a really fascinating question that scientists have been trying to poke and prod at for decades. I mean, this fundamentally gets at what were the ingredients that the planets were made out of? You know, rewind to, you know, more than 4.5 billion years ago, you've got the sun, and then you've got this vast, quote unquote, protoplanetary disk of dust and gas. And there's all sorts of complex chemistry happening in this disk that changes the farther away you get from the sun. So one of the essential questions has been, what was the stuff that Earth coalesced out of, and how much of Earth's water could have been in those ingredients? Recent research suggests that a fair amount of Earth's water actually could have come from stuff that form kind of in Earth's general kind of vicinity of the sun. At least some fraction of this water, however, could have been delivered to Earth through bombardments from asteroids and comets that had more ice because they formed farther out from the sun in the outer solar system. So that accounting question requires a really good understanding of the chemistry of the early solar system. And the best way to sample that directly is to go out to these asteroids and comets, that most of which have been largely unchanged in the 4.5 billion years of the solar system.
You know, we take life for granted, but when you sit back and you think about it, as I'm sure you have many times as a science writer, that in the solar system, as far as we know, Earth is the only one that has life. And, you know, here's this blue ball with oceans, land, people that has evolved over millions of years, and yet no other planets that we know of, again, are anything similar to Earth. It's amazing, really.
It is remarkable. I mean, there's sort of two things that come to mind for me at that point. Number one, that we've actually found oceans elsewhere in the solar system. They're subsurface. So there are moons of Jupiter and Saturn that appear to have pretty large subsurface oceans of liquid water. Of course, is there life in those oceans? We don't know that yet. And we won't know for, you know, for probably years, if not decades to come. But you know, this raises a question about, okay, well, it's one thing to have liquid water somewhere on your world, but it's another to have life sloshing about in that liquid water. The second point is we live at a really unique time because we, for the first time, can actually compare the solar system with other star systems. You know, in the past 30 years, astronomers have identified more than 4,500 planets orbiting stars other than the sun elsewhere in the galaxy. And some of these planets, there's no analog for in the solar system, as far as we know. Massive gas giants that orbit the sun way closer than Jupiter does. Planets that kind of with a mass that sits in between kind of Earth and Jupiter's. We don't really have a planet in the solar system as far as we know with those specs. So, you know, the early ideas of the solar system where it seemed like a very logical, orderly architecture, you know, the small rocky planets close to the sun and the bigger gas giants farther away, like that's not a universal rule. And so one of the big questions now and moving forward is how the solar system's architecture affected the odds that life would arise on the beautiful rocky planet we call Earth.
So, Michael, I want to get back to Lucy for just a couple minutes. What will Lucy's mission be?
So the Lucy mission, well, we're going to expect a launch of Lucy as soon as October 16th. They've got a 3-week launch window. And this mission is going to be flying a really cool trajectory. After it launches, it's going to enter orbit around the sun. It's going to fly by Earth to kind of get a gravity assist. And then it's going to take this sort of kind of elongated orbit around the sun that periodically swoops out toward Jupiter and passes one of these Jupiter Trojan asteroids that kind of orbit alongside Jupiter. They orbit the sun, but they have very similar orbits to Jupiter. And as it does these loops, it's going to do several flybys of sort of a wide cross section of these asteroids, which should hopefully let scientists understand when and where in the solar system these asteroids formed originally before they were kind of rattled into their current orbits by the chaos in the early solar system. Those findings, I think, if I'm remembering right, these flybys will go from the mid to late 2020s into the early 2030s. So the science from this mission is something that we're going to be gathering and learning about for, you know, the next 10, 15 years.
But ultimately, one of the things that the mission will do, we want to do, is collect dust and pebbles. What can we learn from that dust and pebbles?
Right. So Lucy itself will not be collecting samples, but there are missions that NASA and other global space agencies are flying and have flown that do collect samples. There have been 3 asteroid sample missions launched since ever. The Japanese space agency JAXA has done 2. Its Hayabusa 2 spacecraft returned with some samples in December. And NASA is currently flying a mission called OSIRIS-REx, which visited, as you alluded to at the top, one of the likeliest near-Earth asteroids to hit Earth in the next couple centuries, an asteroid called Bennu. Last October, OSIRIS-REx went down to the surface of Bennu for a few seconds and collected probably a couple pounds, we don't know exactly, of dust and pebbles from this object. And OSIRIS-REx and all the data it collected and the samples that it'll return should give us a really good sense of how this kind of asteroid is made, what its chemistry is, how it responds to sunlight and how it sort of heats up and cools off. And all of that will give us a better understanding of how this asteroid's orbit will change over the next century plus which will provide scientists with a much better understanding of the impact risk, which is less than 0.1%. Yeah. I just want to make that clear. I write about this for a living, and I am not concerned.
Ah, well, that's good to hear. Impact risk sounds so scientific. collision is, you know, I hate to refer back to Bruce Willis and Armageddon, the movie, but right. That's what kind of put this on a lot of people's radar, is that some of these objects, like asteroids, could actually collide with the Earth. And, you know, the theory now is that that's what made dinosaurs extinct on this this planet, is that an asteroid hit the planet. So you're reassuring us today that there's just a small chance of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason that there's a small chance is because astronomers and researchers of all stripes have, for the past 30 years, made an extraordinary effort to try to map the solar system and try to identify these objects, these asteroids that orbit kind of within a certain distance of Earth, and then try to understand those orbits really, really well, and then try to fast forward them with computers to try to assess the odds that a future collision could occur. Dino killer asteroids are pretty much off the menu. That object was likely about 6 miles wide. And the near Earth asteroids and when I say near Earth, I'm talking about things that orbit the sun and come within like 121 million miles of the sun. So like very broad strokes, these things could be like tens of millions of miles away from Earth and still be classified as near Earth. But yeah, so discovering these objects, fast forwarding their orbits, really understanding that. The dino killers are off the menu. Those asteroids are, you know, asteroids that big don't pose any discernible impact risk over the next several hundred years. The ones that where we still have work to do are the smaller ones. Things on the order of, you know, 450, 500 feet wide and bigger. Those are smaller, which makes them dimmer, which means that we haven't discovered all of them yet. We're probably about halfway to discovering all of those. And those wouldn't be extinction events. They would be really bad if they hit, like a low probability, high impact event for sure.
Hmm. In your story, one of the things that you talk about, or I should say in the September issue with the Mysteries of the Solar System, that there are 100 million objects that we can see. And I want to be clear here. Is that the solar system or just that we can see in space?
Well, there are, I think, catalogs of objects in space in the tens of billions, or if not more. Within the solar system itself, from the dawn of humankind to now, we found about 1.1 million objects in the solar system. There's likely trillions, right? Particularly once you start counting up the small things. But in terms of the objects that, you know, we've seen in a telescope and have, you know, identified it and we have some sense of its orbit, it's about 1.1 million objects. The crazy thing is, about 90% of those objects have been discovered since 2000. When WITF first hit the airwaves in 1971, there were about 5,000 known asteroids. And now in 2021, we're looking at 1.1 million. And that's how much advancement there's been on the discovery side of things. And it's only going to keep going up. I mean, there are telescopes that are currently being built that will add another probably 5 million plus objects to the solar system in the next decade. So that sort of the curve of discovery is just going up and up and up.
Is it because of how advanced we've become with just these telescopes? I mean, Hubble is the one that it seemed, and you tell me, but it seems as though Hubble was a turning point for space exploration and some of the things that we've discovered.
Absolutely. I mean, the Hubble Space Telescope has, you know, this extraordinary scientific legacy. It plays a role. It's sort of like the for objects in the solar system, it's kind of like the sharpshooter. It is not a survey telescope, which is keeping track of kind of vast swaths of sky. It's the thing you call in when it's like, okay, we've discovered a thing. Now we want the best possible data on that one object. That's where Hubble has been huge. The big advancements have been in these huge survey telescopes, where you might have one just really big ground-based telescope that's looking, or maybe like arrays of smaller telescopes. And that these observatories are scanning the sky constantly to try to find things that are moving across the sky. And then they're comparing that with the objects we know now. And the crucial thing has been, in the last 30 years, digital camera sensors have gotten big enough and reliable enough and sensitive enough that you can hook them up to these big telescopes, and you can automate a lot of what used to be a cumbersome manual process with an astronomer like hunched over a big glass photographic plate. So we can see dimmer objects, which means we can see smaller things farther out into the solar system, and we can automate a lot of this process with computer code. Those two things together have enabled massive numbers of discoveries in the last 30 years. Mm.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, most of the space news that we've heard about in this country recently concerns billionaires going into space, or maybe even another moon landing. Why aren't we hearing more about some of the things that you've been talking about or that you have written about? Why aren't we hearing more about that?
Well, I think, you know, the two examples you just brought up, those are human missions, right? The, you know, questions about sending humans, you know, more than 50 miles up or, you know, into orbit or to the moon. And I think there's something really powerful about the human narrative to that. But these robotic missions are extraordinary because these robots can go places and do things that humans can't and probably won't do for decades, if not centuries. So these robots that we're sending out into the solar system to fly by objects, to orbit them, to land on them, to sample them, bring them back. These are our eyes and ears venturing out into our cosmic home. And I think there's something really profound about that. I mean, we can't go out ourselves, but we can get, you know, through these robots, see the solar system in a richer way than ever before. Mm.
You know, there's a story out there today, maybe you've seen it, about Alan Shepard sneaking a golf club on board a space flight and playing golf on the moon, that he actually got in trouble for that. Just to tease our audience a little bit, National Geographic Magazine science writer Michael Greshko, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.